This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 17th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, coming to you from rather toasty Phoenix, Arizona, where today we should hit 110 on this Sunday afternoon. And just finished up a week where I was on the East Coast, where it was much nicer in terms of temperatures. So now I'm back over here where we're roasting and getting ready to begin our monsoon season. So that means humidity is going to kick up a bit now, and we may see the big thunderstorms come through. So, hey, it's going to be a fun time coming up here. Really hot and potentially really miserable. So we'll see how things go. But let's talk about what we're going to be looking at this week in the area of taxes. First, we're going to talk about last-minute relief the IRS provided this week to corporations, calendar year corporations, and specifically, who believe they might owe the alternative minimum tax to corporate AMT. So that's for large corporations. And 3 days before the payment would have been due for the second estimate, the IRS decided to again postpone providing any penalties that are related to the corporate minimum tax. So you can ignore your corporate minimum tax liability in computing your amount to be paid to the IRS for the second quarter. However, you know, hopefully you're listening to this early on the morning of the 17th, and probably it's still too late at this point to stop the process and not make the payment. But if you find out you kind of forgot that you should have made a payment that was AMT related, I guess you kind of got bailed out. Unless you heard about this Friday, I have real doubts that's going to do anybody a whole lot of good. Also, we're going to discuss about a denial of a request for an en banc rehearing in the Farhi case we discussed a while back here. The D.C. Circuit turned down a request for an en banc rehearing. We're going to also talk about Department of Justice release regarding a Georgia CPA who pled guilty to tax charges related to a syndicated conservation easement program that he was promoting for his high net worth clients. We'll talk about what got him in trouble. And I think one thing got him in more trouble than other things, because suddenly the prosecutors looked up and said, hey, we can sell that to a jury, that shows criminal intent. And I think that was going to be the big problem that he had. I'm not so sure it's as easy to convict him on some of the more obscure things like, you know, did he understand the transaction didn't have economic substance, et cetera, et cetera. I can see juries' eyes glaze over trying to look at things like that. But yeah, when you're backdating documents, that just looks bad no matter how you're doing it. So that was a problem. And finally, we'll talk about the taxpayer advocate who issued a warning this week about relying on generative AI for answering tax questions. Now, she was concerned with consumer tax software, but I want to go ahead and point out that there's also a big problem for any CPA attempting to use generative AI to handle tax research issues. I've seen a lot of people who just totally misunderstand what it is that a chatbot using a large language model on a generative AI basis, you know, what exactly it's doing and why it's not an answer machine, right? People think it is. People think it is a substitute for a search engine. If that's what you believe it is, you are wrong. We'll talk specifically about why you're wrong. But it is not a replacement for a search engine. It does not look at a database of correct answers and give you the right one. It's a little more, it's a way more complicated than that. So we'll talk about that and why it is not a great tool. You know, you certainly can't rely on the tool. And since the SSTS came out this year, and we had added to the new SSTS a specific requirement you as a CPA understand the tools you're using, that's a big problem if you don't understand how ChatGPT works and the concept of hallucinations. So we'll get there. Let's go ahead and talk about this last-minute relief of Notice 2024-47. That was issued on June 14th of this year. So 2024-47, that provides, it grants relief from estimated tax penalties on a corporation that underpays its tax in a manner related to the alternative minimum tax, right? Corporate AMT was added back in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017, various types of it, you know, so it's been around actually for a while. But this is one, and it really gets messy on the corporate AMT back in that structure. So we're going to take a look at, You know, basically that confusion means a lot of companies have trouble determining if they're going to be subject to it or not. The IRS has been waiving these estimated tax penalties, but they're taking their time to do so. This relief provides for tax years that begin in 2024. Right? We had guidance last year that covered the 23 years. Now we're piecemealing 24's guidance in this area. This is for payments through and including August 15th of 2024. So any payments due through those dates is going to get there. So that's going to be the second estimates pretty much for everybody, right? Doesn't matter. It's going to be the set, you know, through the second estimates or first estimates, whatever you have by August 15th, depending upon your fiscal year. If your calendar year, it will be the second estimates will be covered at that point. Thus, the third quarter payments for 2024 do not get this relief. Calendar year or later, the third payment is still on paper due. Now, remember, the second payment was also on paper due until June 14th, which was Friday, right? And so that's going to be an issue. It was issued due to confusion over when this tax will apply, who it applies to. Because of continued confusion, the IRS looking to get more guidance out, they've decided to push the penalty back again. So we're not going to have the penalty for a while. Okay. Now, the prior relief had expired on the payments due through May 15th of 2024. Thus, the second quarter payments from the calendar year corporation that would have been required on June the 17th we're not going to be covered by this later relief that applied to second quarter payments, right? Or even potentially first quarter payments, depending upon when you started your corporation's fiscal year. So as I said, that was 3 days after the relief was issued and actually only one working day before the relief would take effect, right? You know, Saturday and Sunday aren't usually considered working days. So we have Friday, they issue this relief during the day on Friday, and it's applying to the payments that were going to go out that are going to be paid and were had to be paid by Monday. So very, very limited time frame for relief. And there have been a lot of complaints. Last time there were that the IRS waited till the last second to grant the relief for the first quarter estimates. Now we got exactly the same issue coming up with the second quarter estimates. So again, now the good news is not many corporations are subject. Certainly you're an S corporation would never be, and that's the largest number of corporations we have are S-elected corporations, at least ones that believe they are S. That's a whole long different story. But even C corporations, unless they are really large, are not subject to the current AMT. So because of that, right, we end up with, this is only a few corporations, they have tax departments that in theory most likely can handle this situation, even as weirdly as the IRS is handling it, but it'd certainly be nicer if they would move faster. So we're going to be facing the same questions as we come up to the payments due on September the 15th. You know, is the IRS going to extend it once again so we dodge it? You know, we get to push it back and the third quarter estimates won't be due? Or is that going to be the time they're going to really, really, really let it go? As the law stands right now, the ones for September are go. They're on. You have to make them. But we don't know the status. So keep your eyes on that if that does affect you. Next up, we're going to talk about the case of Alan Fari versus Commissioner. And this is an order denying Mr. Fari's request for an en banc rehearing of his case before the D.C. Circuit. The denial was issued in a pair of orders that came out on June the 13th of 2024. One order was the general order of the court, you know, from the senior judge, that the request should be denied. And then there was a secondary one that said, and because no other judge on the court had requested that the case go forth a rehearing, they're going to go ahead and just grant, you're going to say, sorry, you're out of luck, we're not granting this relief. Now, this was a case where originally the tax court had ruled in Mr. Fari's favor, right? Had ruled the IRS lacked the ability to directly assess and collect taxes or penalties under Internal Revenue Code Section 6038B. And that's mainly Form 5471 and the failure to file that form. What the court ruled, or tax court ruled, was that this penalty could not be assessed just like the IRS assesses a tax, right? The IRS assesses a tax. They essentially then are able to collect it unless you file a petition in tax court. And in that case, you can delay the collection until the tax court case is over. But if you don't want to go to tax court, then you have to pay the tax. They have a right directly to go to pay the tax. What the tax court ruled was that this penalty was one where you did not have that, you didn't have that whole situation where the IRS could just say, hey, guy, pay up, right? Pay up. If you don't want to pay up, you have to go to tax court. You can't go to any other court. And then we can move straight to collection. In this case, the IRS would have to itself have filed a claim in the U.S. District Court in order to pursue collection. They would assert that, you know, you owed the money. Now, nobody here really is denying that Mr. Fari is going to have, you know, owes this penalty. The argument was that the IRS had basically lost the statute because they hadn't pursued their claim in the way they should have, and now they're out of luck. Okay, IRS obviously didn't like that answer. They appealed the case to the D.C. Circuit because that was where the case would go, to the Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, right? The three-judge panel who had heard that case, and that's normally how courts of appeals hear cases. Normally, they don't bring every single judge in the room to hear the case. That's not the way this tends to work, right? They don't have time to do that, and those, you know, panels where every judge is there and everyone has questions and issues, that can make the case very difficult to handle. So what they do is they randomly assign three judges to hear the case. And those three judges then issue their decision. There's an odd number for the obvious reason that that allows you to get a majority opinion, right? Decide on the results, guys. What's the result? And, you know, at that point, we will get a majority opinion out of the court is the theory. Now, the panel decided that although the law itself was ambiguous on whether the IRS could or could not assess this penalty and collect it, go straight to collection, you know, if the taxpayer didn't file the tax court petition, they decided that the way the law was enacted, where it was meant to simplify the administration of the penalty, that particular change in the law suggested to them that Congress could not have intended what would have been one of the consequences of this, at least in cases where a foreign tax credit was in play. In those cases, the IRS would make part of the assessment in a denial of the foreign tax credit, which would be an assessable tax and would therefore have to go through the assessment and then the appeals process and go to tax court, right? That whole structure. And then the other part of it, which is the part we normally pay, that part, well, hopefully we don't pay, but you know, but if you pay, if you go after it, it's always normally this one, the fixed dollar amount, which is reduced by any foreign tax credit penalty or any foreign tax credit disallowance. So, you know, it's integrated with it. That part of the penalty would have to go through the district court routine. And of course, as the panel noted, well, wait, we could easily have a totally inconsistent result with the tax court saying, hey, IRS, you're wrong. They don't owe this penalty, so they can keep the foreign tax credit. And the, you know, the court of appeal or not, or I should say the district court saying, oh no, IRS is right. You owe this. And the law says if you owe one, you know, if you owe the tax and the disallowance is there too. So it's like the two decisions have to be consistent. They said there's no way this does not work. Right. And it's not whichever case goes first wins. So they said because of that, that couldn't have been Congress's intent. They said this becomes an basically assessable, you know, assessable penalty, not accessible, but assessable. My slide's wrong. You know, it will become a fully assessable penalty, not a divided one. Okay. Now, as I said, normally we have three judges hear the case in any court of appeals. But there is a right for the losing party or a party that loses in some way to ask for the case to be reheard by basically an en banc panel. Now, in all of the circuit courts of appeal except for one, the en banc panel is a panel of all judges that sit on that court of appeals. In this case, the D.C. Circuit is not the circuit. That is the exception. The exception circuit is the ninth. It's because of sheer size. You know, there are way more judges on the Ninth Circuit than any other circuit. That's because we've yet to figure out how to divide the Ninth Circuit. So we could split it up without splitting up the state of California or resulting in a really odd situation of kind of no real geographical unity on what makes up this, you know, this Court of Appeals district. So because of those sorts of problems, it sat there for a long time with California sitting there. As far as California, like I said, kind of needs to be divided up because it's bigger than, as I recall, certain districts on its own, you know, Court of Appeals area. So it's like, yeah. Then I want to divide up California because that'd be a total mess. You could have one set of law. One the law is deemed to be good law in Northern California, but unconstitutional in Southern, and that's not workable. So we have this problem. So they're different, but that's not going to hit the D.C. Circuit. They can go ahead and have all justices come in, all judges come in. However, it was decided that there was nothing about this decision that suggested it would benefit from a rehearing. And specifically, one thing that's really key is no member of the D.C. Circuit actually said, yeah, I think we should rehear this in total. You know, I think there's some issues here, you know, that I think could be problematical with the decision. So we're going to ask for a rehearing. So that did not happen in this case. And because of that, because nobody asked for the rehearing, the original panel's ruling holds. That means we are still, at least in the D.C. Circuit, this is still considered a penalty that the IRS can assess and go after directly. And however, to the tax court, which reported the other way, presumably to the tax court, they still consider it not to be one. So we're kind of waiting on another circuit to come in and tell us how this is going to work. And there was at least an article on Tax Note this week where the author was concerned that we could see wildly inconsistent tests for what is an assessable and non-assessable penalties in different circuits that would eventually force the Supreme Court to come into this issue. But right now, as I say, the attempt to get this reheard by the D.C. Circuit failed. So we'll just have to see how things move forward in this area. As I said, basically, yeah, it's going to be best for clients to file 5471s and not be in this position or get a full waiver. But we still don't know how this is going to work. My guess is we'll just have to see how the IRS reacts outside of the D.C. Circuit. You know, do they decide to try to file? Because here's the other problem. If it is really accessible, they really can't go file suit in the U.S. District Court first. So, yeah, we got a problem either way. Next up. We have an announcement from the Department of Justice. They had issued a press release. They announced a guilty plea in a criminal case by a CPA that was promoting syndicated conservation easements to his clients, right? This is a release from the U.S. Department of Justice that came out on June the 13th, 2024. It was entitled, Georgia CPA pleads guilty to promoting syndicated conservation easement tax scheme involving fraudulent charitable deductions. Now, this CPA pled guilty to promoting an illegal charitable contribution scheme to high-income clients. We'll discuss what this is, but this was not a scheme that he came up with. It's a scheme that basically a promoter approached him and essentially said, hey, look, go ahead and do this. We're going to form these partnerships. And if you can refer your clients to us to buy this tax shelter. And if you do so, you'll be paid a commission for doing so. Okay. That kind of background there. Now, at this point in time, when they got this guilty plea from the CPA, things weren't really going well for this particular program. The two creators of the program had already been convicted on tax crimes and sentenced to 23 and 25 years, respectively. As they would say, that will get the CPA's attention, right? Okay, those guys have been handed 23 and 25-year sentences. So now the Department of Justice says, you want to talk with us about a deal, right? That's kind of it. Now, he has pled guilty and he will be sentenced on, I think he's scheduled for October 16th to have a sentencing hearing. And his potential sentence could be up to 5 years on one of the counts he pled guilty to and 3 years on the other. So if it was to be served basically consecutively and not concurrently, and he got the max sentence, that would be up to 8 years in prison. Now, understanding that rarely do federal convictions result in the maximum sentence because of the federal sentencing guidelines, that doesn't mean that's a realistic penalty, but DOJ likes to use those because that's the scary numbers, right? I would suspect the actual amount of time he spends in jail will be minimal, if any. But for purposes of the press release, they will definitely use that 5 year and 3 year dates, you know, suggesting you do this, you get 8 years in prison. So keep that in mind. And definitely, you know, let's put it this way, a felony conviction for tax, you know, for tax crimes is probably going to mean you're going to be an ex-CPA. So yeah, it's usually not a good thing. right? They don't like convicted felons, right? If you're convicted of a felony for something related to, you know, what is considered to be the practice of accounting in most states, that's grounds for saying bye. You know, you're not a CPA anymore. So that's a potential problem for him. Now, what this thing was a partnership would acquire land or a land-owning company. So it set up a new partnership. These two guys, right, the two that are spending the extended time in the slammer, they would go out and they would form a new partnership and either acquire land directly or acquire a land-owning company with a partnership. And what they wanted to do was make a charitable contribution of a qualified conservation easement of the land. Now, that's fine, but, you know, to get the conservation easement deduction, because it would normally be all capital gain, be all, you know, capital gain if there's a gain there. Remember, you can only get up to the basis, and there is no point of me, as I tell clients all the time, if you spend $1,000 and get a $1,000 deduction, you're not going to make money tax-wise. You're going to reduce the $1,000 cost, but since we don't have above 100% tax rate, you're not going to make money. However, because in the case of making a contribution of a capital gain asset, you can claim the fair market value as a deduction, even though your basis in it is very, very low and you don't recognize the gain, it is theoretically possible to make money off of that. The only problem is we need a lot of appreciation for this to work. So what would happen is they would have appraisers that would get a valuation of the easement they planned to donate just over a year after they got the property and after they'd got their investors normally. Talk about why I say normally there, because turns out they played a little fast and loose with worrying about whether investors need to be in the program before they, you know, basically before they could use the gain. Turns out this group would apparently, at least the CPA would set it up so that you could come in the partnership after they already made the donation, you know exactly what you're going to get. And you backdate your documents to pretend you were there on the day of the contribution. Because, gang, you really can't buy it after the fact. But that was another issue. And what the appraisers would do is they would appraise just the easement. Remember, we're not talking about the land itself. This is just a conservation easement that says certain things can't be done with the land. And the value of that was appraised to be worth over 10 times what they had paid for the land. So, of course, the land would have to appreciate effectively at least, you know, by more than that number, because the easement is generally determined by taking the value of the land before you put the easement and the value of the land afterwards. So we're talking about amazing land they're buying that would go up in value dramatically, and they knew it every time. And despite the fact that they had the land that went up so dramatically in value, they didn't sell that land, which would be the rational thing to do, right? If you can get over 10 times what you paid for something a year ago, you don't donate that to charity, right? You basically sell it. You're going to be way ahead just selling it, pocketing the cash, paying the capital gains rate. But that wasn't what they're going to do, obviously, because turns out maybe this valuation was somewhat overstated. It was wildly overstated. 23, 25 years, I think we can lean hard on wildly overstated, right? The partnership would then claim this inflated deduction and pass it out to the partners that interest had been sold to. So essentially, right, they get this, there's nothing left in the partnership, so their, you know, their account's gone, you know, sorry guys, there's nothing left to distribute to you, but hey, you know, you got this huge deduction, you're reducing your taxes, so you put in $200,000, you reduced your taxes by, let's say, $500,000, so you're good, we took our fee, we're good, we paid the CPA the referral fee, CPA is good, all is well, all's happy, except the IRS. That's the problem. Now, the CPA here had done various things per the release, and these are things that the DOJ is, of course, suggesting are all part of the criminal conspiracy to evade the taxes for his clients. He had, from the beginning, known the scheme lacked any economic substance, right? There was nothing there. They were not really buying land as an investment, right, to hold or do something with. They were buying land solely based on this, based on their, basically what they'd been told was a guarantee that this land would be valued well above what they had paid. They would get a deduction that would end up reducing their taxes by far more than what they had put in. So, you know, hey, great. We're good. You know, we put in 200 grand, we save a half million in taxes. We feel great, right? All is done. He knew the client solely received tax benefits from the partnership. That was all they were buying it for, right? That's how you knew it lacked economic substance, right? And they did not have any other involvement with the partnership. He knew they put up fake votes, that there'd be votes in the partnership for what to do with the land, but these votes were effectively rigged and for show only, because everybody knew you couldn't vote to sell the land because there wasn't a buyer. You could never find a buyer at the value anywhere close to the value that they had, you know, basically put out there. Probably you couldn't find a buyer for the land in the partnership, even at what the partnership had paid for it, because remember, since they're going to get this hugely inflated valuation, they really had little incentive to negotiate down the deal and had more incentive to just, you know, get land, right? So they would entice people to sell the land. They could obviously, you know, they didn't care what they paid out. They wouldn't. Why would they care? This is going to all work on something totally different. So I have a feeling if you actually sold the land, you might have had trouble getting the money paid back for it. And this, I think, was the deadly move. He encouraged some clients to purchase interest after the donation had already been made by the partnership. They got in too late. You know, he encouraged them to backdate their documents to make it appear that they had become partners before the date of donation. And presumably that would have required cooperation by the partnership itself, because obviously they don't have the money, right? The money came in afterward. So they would all paper it over, pretend that everything had been agreed to, taken care of before the donation. And that's the thing I think the DOJ would think, we can sell that to a jury. We can sell that as obvious evidence of fraudulent activity, right? By these high rollers, he was in there getting these unwarranted tax breaks for the high rollers. And he was doing it so badly, he was even cheating by faking the dates. So even if you think maybe there's a chance they were valued properly, it didn't matter. There's no way these clients at least, could have possibly qualified for the benefit. And so, yeah, that looks bad. Telling people to backdate things is not normally a good show, a good look. And it certainly can look, it certainly not only can look, but often is wildly criminal. So, yeah, we got a problem. Okay. Now, he had earned over $1 million in commissions off selling the programs over a number of years. So, you know, that's also a good number for the prosecution, because, you know, most of the people on the jury probably don't have $1 million that they have earned, right? You know, at best, they might have earned $1 million over the past 10 or 15 years, but not $1 million over this short time frame for essentially doing nothing but sending your clients down over to these guys, right? So it looked bad. And his client had claimed over $14 million in illegal charitable contributions. So, yeah, there's that. And those come into play for the sentencing guidelines, which is part of the reason why that's going to be mentioned and in play. Right? It's there. Now, here's the catch. Remember, anybody here, if you're a CPA, you're an attorney, you're an EA, and you get approached by somebody to get your clients into a program of some sort, and they even agree, you know, we're going to pay you. Now, the first problem, and I'll talk about this from CPA, is because I know this one all the way. You know, a CPA always, always, always has to disclose to the client if somebody is paying you, right? If you're getting any sort of payment or commission directly or indirectly for referring a client to somebody, you have to disclose. There is not an option, right? I have people all the time saying it doesn't matter how they structure, it doesn't matter if you get a gift from them at the end of the year. I don't care what they do. If you're getting something and it's clear you're getting it because you're referring your client to them, you have to tell the client. And also, the other problem is you are responsible for that program, right? You've got to do it. Now, the problem is those big commissions make it look like, not just look like slightly, look very much like, you know, you may very well be improperly influenced by earning that money and not worrying about whether or not this thing really holds up. You have a $1 million plus incentive to just conclude it works like they say it does, even though your training should have told you this doesn't work. There's no way. right? The only way this works is you win the audit lottery, right? And that's, yeah, that's bad. That's not going to happen. So that's the issue. You are responsible, right? And these programs, we talked a little bit about those ones with the term remainder trust. Those were marketed to CPAs, EAs, and attorneys, right? So counsel's not out of this either. They'll market to them, get them to recommend it. And by the way, I think really once we get to the attorney level, gang, you guys are just going to be roasted on these things. You know, if you cannot demonstrate that you independently concluded, you know, that this was a valid thing, and getting paid looks bad, and that's going to be a problem also basically with legal ethics if not properly taken care of with the client in a way it needs to be, which, yeah, just lots of mess. And of course, nobody wants to say that, because a client can probably figure out pretty quickly that, hey, wait, if my advisor is being paid by these guys to get me into this, am I really getting independent advice? Right? Advice that's not tainted by the advisor's interest in getting that check. That's a realistic question. That is a question you can easily sell to a jury, right? If there's lawsuits. And because, of course, the IRS knows about who did this now, and I'm sure a lot of those people that paid that got the $14 million in deductions have discovered they've been disallowed, I would certainly expect there are going to be some civil cases against the CPA, right? Looking to recover because those people got involved, paid taxes, interest, penalties. Because remember, we go back to case law, you really can't rely on the advice of somebody who is getting is being paid only if you go into the program. And of course, if they didn't know that, then he's absolutely dead on ethics rules. So it's like, there's no good way out of this. Finally, we have the taxpayer advocate issued a notice on June 11th of 2024. Is AI-generated tax advice making the grade, right? Consumer tax software vendors had begun to offer AI chatbots to their customers to answer tax questions. If you can't see how that could go wrong, I don't think you were thinking too hard, right? This obviously can go wrong very, very easily. So that's a big issue, right? How that goes wrong. The taxpayer advocate warned that these chatbots often provide erroneous information when asked more complex questions. And she cited a Washington Post report where the software got between 30 to 50% of 16 what they called complex questions wrong. Now, these questions aren't ones that most of us would consider to be complex questions. They're actually pretty simple, not simple, but ones that we mostly consider fine. You know, like if an adult child lives with a parent, you know, can they claim the head of household filing status? And that's somewhat of an it depends, but it's definitely possible. And we had some chatbots answering no, right? Well, that's problematical. But we have the problem even as tax pros, right? We need to be aware of issues with AI because many are tempted to use chatbots such as ChatGPT, Google's Gemini, or Microsoft Copilot as tax research tools. Because too many people confuse chatbots with search engines, that they are effectively just a much easier to use search engine because they kind of look that way. And it's easy to persuade somebody that that's what it is, right? The bots are almost always very, very confident in their answer. In fact, to be totally honest, I think ChatGPT is the worst at showing absolute confidence in things that it has no right to be confident in. It also, unlike the others, doesn't tend to very often offer citations back to where it got the information. Copilot from Microsoft and Gemini will often offer citations. Now, those citations may prove to you that the answer is wrong, but at least you got a way to follow up. It's a little bit tougher with ChatGPT. And there also are large language models. That's how they work. They're LLMs. How LLMs work can explain the problem we see. What they are doing, an LLM tries to work a certain way. LLMs do not consult a detailed database of correct answers and respond. They don't have a whole bunch of databases in, you know, multiple topics and respond off that by having understood the topic and come up with the correct answer. That's not how this works, right? And even though you might hope that's how it works, they are absolutely not proper replacements for a search engine, despite marketing suggesting they are. I will tell you flat out, a search engine is far more likely to get the right answer. Or if it can't get an answer, that's a hint to you that maybe there's something wrong with your question. The chatbot will never make you assume there's something wrong with your question. That's going to be one of our problems. Okay. So what they do is they look to craft a response to a query by building a response piece by piece, determining based on probabilities derived from the training data in its text. What is the most likely next piece of an answer? Looking for the most likely next thing it should say to give an expected answer. And it really is kind of an expected answer. Keep that in mind. You know, it's trying to write like a human would write. And so it's going to give you an answer that would appear plausibly written by a human. But it's probably not going to say, I don't know. Right? I realize we don't like saying that either in many cases, but it's probably going to keep pushing forward regardless of the situation. Now, if there are lots of articles and documents in its training data that provide a correct answer, that's going to influence the odds it's computing to what would be an expected response. And it will tend to steer it that way. And when that is true, it can come up with an excellent answer, right, to the question. So for instance, let's take a look at this question that I put up to ChatGPT. Can you provide me details on the federal court decision that ruled that a taxpayer may claim a deduction for expenses for which the taxpayer lacks documentation, but which the taxpayer can show such expenses would have been incurred and that there is a method to reasonably estimate what the taxpayer paid? Let's say I'm posing this question because I can't remember the name of the case, but I'm pretty sure such a case is out there. Okay? By the way, you should be, because it's the most cited case in the tax law, which means there are a lot of documents that discuss this case. So believe it or not, I just keyed up a very simple answer for ChatGPT. But if you don't know much about tax, you may not know it's a simple answer. And what did ChatGPT tell me in response to this? Certainly it can answer that question. There are court decisions you're referring to is likely the Cohen versus Commissioner case. This landmark case established the Cohen rule, which allows taxpayers to estimate expenses even if they lack detailed documentation, as long as there is a reasonable basis for the estimation. Now, Cohen versus Commissioner, it also gives us a citation. That is the proper citation for the Cohen case. Bingo. It's actually given us a citation. It's told us what that case is. It's told us where to go find it. And that is absolutely correct, what it's done so far. Nothing's wrong. The background, George M. Cohen, a well-known Broadway producer, songwriter, and performer, was involved in this case. Yes. The IRS disallowed many of his claimed deductions due to a lack of detailed records, right? The court acknowledged that Cohen undoubtedly incurred expenses in producing his shows, operating his business. I mean, he was a big producer. This is like, you know, Steven Spielberg. Does Steven Spielberg have expenses making those movies? Yeah. We don't doubt he has expenses putting together the movies, doing that stuff. There's no doubt, right? Although he did not have detailed records substantial of expenses, the court recognized that it was unreasonable to disallow all deductions just because precise documentation was lacking. And Judge Learned Hand ruled the taxpayer should be allowed to make a reasonable estimation of expenses based on credible evidence. That is a very good quick summation of the Cohen case. Right? So far, it's doing great. Right? It's doing exactly what we'd like. The key takeaways. Must be reasonable estimation. The taxpayers can estimate expenses if they can provide a reasonable basis for those estimates under the Cohen rule. The credibility of evidence. When exact records are not necessary, some credible evidence or testimony must support the estimation of expenses. You can't just pull them out of thin air, right? And the court has the discretion to determine what constitutes a reasonable estimation based on the circumstances. All of those are basically true, right? Implications. The ruling provides some flexibility for taxpayers who may not have meticulous records but can really substantiate their expenses. It emphasizes the importance of maintaining such documentation as possible, but acknowledges a lack of perfect records should not result in complete disallowance of legitimate expenses. Right? That's the rule. And the Cohen rule continues to influence tax court decisions, writing a framework for cases where taxpayers can show they incurred expenses but lack complete documentation. The only problem I have with this response is it failed to note Congress's reaction by adding anti-Cohen provisions. in for area for things like entertainment expenses, travel expenses, right? Entertainment is now basically gone, but hey, what the heck, back when we could deduct it. Travel expenses, meals, and charitable contributions, right? If I was going to, let's say I was teaching a course in this area, that it was, let's say, a college-level tax course, and somebody's teaching that, I was asked to give a comment on this particular response, I would probably only downgrade it for failing to mention the anti-Cohen provisions. But as far as discussing Cohen itself, yeah, it's doing fine. So that's there. It leaves the implication it would work for everything. It won't. But I didn't really ask that. So, okay, we can give this like an A, not an A plus because it didn't go the extra mile, but we'll give it an A. But now let's change the question a bit here. If you ask certain questions, you're likely to get what is effectively a made-up answer. That sounds like an answer to a task question with made-up authorities, such as a question that's looking for, and these are the problems, a case supporting a position your client wants to take. You know the answer the client wants. You now ask it to go find cases that will let you take that position. And this is going to be especially a problem if that position itself has no real support. ChatGPT may succeed in showing you cases. I didn't say there were real ones, right? Or I didn't say the case says what ChatGPT is going to say or stands for the position ChatGPT is talking about, right? All of that could be different. So that sort of question gets us in trouble, right? In essence, and actually, if you look at the Cohen question I posed, had there been no Cohen case, you know, and that whole part of the law was gone, or the Cohen case gone the other way and said you absolutely have to have documentation for every expense, then, you know, it might have still made up some case that would have claimed came the way Cohen did, right? Or an answer where there's recently been a key development that renders prior articles and guidance outdated. So its training database has a problem, and since it doesn't really understand the question, it doesn't recognize, hey, wait, this thing was a big deal. And because of that, I need to ignore articles before, as we'll discover in the case I'm going to talk about, 2011, and start looking at what's happened since 2011 and see, you know, did the courts go along with the regulation that was put in place in 2011? The answer has been generally yes. So pre-2011 cases are become problematical. Many of them now have been reversed by the very circuits that they're going to cite the cases from. So we get there. Let's talk about this question. Can you provide me, is my question to it, information on how the common law mailbox rule can be used to prove timely filing of a U.S. income tax return mailed at the post office on the final day for filing a return? Please give me citations to cases that support your position. That is my question to the chatbot. What did the chatbot come back with? The common law mailbox rule can be used to prove the timely filing of a U.S. income tax return when it was mailed at the post office on the final day for filing. That statement is probably at least 95% untrue. Okay, I might even go to 100%, but I'll go 95. I'll say that I may get some factual cases where maybe I could, but I really find trouble. I think that sentence is just flat wrong. Right, it's totally missing out on what's happened. The rule essentially presumes that a properly mailed document is deemed to be received by the addressee. That second sentence is correct about the common law mailbox rule. Right, in the context of tax filing, it means that if you can prove you mailed your return on time, it is presumed to be filed on time even if the IRS does not have a record of receiving it. That is also a misstatement. It only provides for timely mailing if you have it postmarked under 7502, and that document is delivered to the IRS after the final day for filing. So essentially, it covers that situation. And that is not covered. If you just argue mailbox rule on that, you will lose. At this point, in every case since 2011, you have lost if you took that position. So what's the mailbox rule? It talks about that. Document considered filed when properly addressed with sufficient postage by the mail. Basically considered received by the party you sent it to, right? As long as you mailed it. So it's properly addressed, sufficient postage, deposit in the mail, right? So there is a presumption of delivery, presumption of timely delivery, you know, assuming you mailed it with sufficient time. Now, 7502A introduced the postmark rule, which then says that if you postmark it by that date, we're fine, as long as it gets to the IRS you know, eventually gets delivered. That's a different issue. The burden of proof is on the taxpayer to establish those conditions were met. The burden of proof is on the party asserting the quantum law mailbox rule to show it was properly addressed, had sufficient postage, was positive mail. But again, as I said, currently, this really doesn't work for taxpayers. So in other contexts, it's correct. The party asserting it would need to prove those things. That is their burden. The IRS position, the IRS generally requires physical evidence such as a postmark certified mail receipt to establish timely mailing. Well, a little bit misleading there because the law, which means Congress, requires physical evidence such as a postmark certified mail receipt, at least as the IRS has interpreted what was deemed to be by the courts for many years an ambiguous part of the code, and the court split on a key question. Was 7502 enacted by Congress to supplant, basically wipe out, and you have to use this as your proof of mailing rather than the common law mailbox rule, or is it a secondary way of doing it? And we had a split among the circuits on that question. Some circuits said the mailbox rule worked. Some circuits said it didn't. You had to use 7502. And some circuits had a kind of intermediate position. So we ended up with all kinds of weirdness up until 2011 when the IRS rewrote the regs. And now it appears we have the courts pretty much agreeing that because the law itself was not clear, the IRS has resolved that in a reasonable fashion. And while certain courts might have determined they like some other way of reading it differently, they also recognize that other courts at the same level of them had come up with the opposite conclusion. So basically the courts have now said, okay, this is how we're going to handle this since the 2011 changes. Under the common law mailbox rule, testimony or other evidence of mailing can be used to establish timely filing. Right? And if only the common law mailbox rule mattered. That's the problem, right? But it's giving the idea that you can use this thing, clearly. Key cases supporting the common law mailbox rule. It's going to lead with two cases that did find you could use the rule, right? The first case was the Ninth Circuit case of Anderson versus U.S., right? The court held that that credible testimony regarding the mailing of a tax return was sufficient to prove timely filing on the common law mailbox rule. It emphasized presumption of delivery if taxpayer could show the document was properly mailed. Okay. That's a 1992 Ninth Circuit case. Note, well before 2011. And a state of Wood, right? This is an Eighth Circuit case from 1989, affirmed 1990 by the Eighth Circuit, right? This case, the taxpayer accepted credible evidence from the taxpayer's representative that a return was mailed on time despite the absence of a postmark or certified mail receipt. The court concluded the testimony was sufficient to prove timely mailing and the assumption that the document was delivered. Now, those two are real cases, but they're dated before a major change took place, right? They involve years before 2011. Finally, there's another one here. And this is the case of Salo versus Commissioner, right? The Salo case, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 1989-40. And according to ChatGPT, the tax court found the taxpayer's credible testimony about mailing the return was adequate to establish timely mailing. The court highlighted that under the common law mailbox rule, credible evidence of mailing can be used to prove timely filing. Great. Except here's the case. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 1989-40 does not involve a taxpayer named Salo. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hallucinations. In fact, if you go back and check that case, you're going to find that this was actually Ashdown versus Commissioner, a totally unrelated case in 1989, right? Totally unrelated 1989 case. That was a memorandum decision, right? Totally unrelated. Had nothing to do with this issue. It certainly is not a case from somebody named Salo. So why did ChatGPT come up with it? Well, because it kind of ran out of cases. So it invented a brand new case. It knew what a case looked like. A tax court case looks like taxpayer versus commissioner. It knew the way a tax court case was cited. You know, Tax Court Memo 1989-40, right? So it knows that. Now, This is a case. Back then, we saw the citations much more often until the tax court started putting them on their website, as done in the format that, as I recall, I think they're using here the CCH format, which would be 1989 TC Memo 48, you know, 40. So that would be how they'd do it. Well, this is obviously a problem, that there is no such case. There is no Sallow case. The Sallow case never did this. Again, why? It ran out of cases meeting your criteria. It thought it needed more than two, so, and it knows what a case, again, the case is predictable. And by the way, the case description reads like very much like the other two did. Properly outlined, properly set up, credible. It's a credible real warning, except it is a total fabrication. Now, you might say it's a lie, but there's really no conscious action here. ChatGPT is merely taking a look at what's essentially, you know, the probabilities and coming up with a plausible answer, an answer that would appear like something a human would be expected to write. And it never, ever, ever goes back and double checks that what it's generating actually exists. It really has no easy capability of doing that, right? So a search engine would never have turned up 1989-40 case for Sallow. It doesn't exist, and there's no way it would score high in rankings, that somebody, you know, a case that mentioned that would somehow score high in rankings, unless you actually wrote a fake Sallow versus Commissioner article, and then you make sure your search in the search engine was specifically for a sentence in that article. Then you could trick it. But otherwise, yeah. Nope, you can't really get this out of it, but the ChatGPT will do this easily. Okay, some more stuff here. It went on to say how established proof of mailing. You can have credible testimony. Who observed the mailing can be sufficient. Sworn affidavits, keeping a copy of mailed items support the claim. And other evidence can contribute the mailing date, such as a diary entry or business records. Right? Limitation, the IRS prefers physical proof, such as postmark certified mail receipt. I tell you that. The law prefers that. In fact, the law, we can argue now, demands that. Right? The accepted common law mailbox rule is subject to discretion of court and the credibility of the evidence presented. So, yeah. Well, roughly that's true in theory, since the mailbox rule is, as long as you met all the proof points and it would apply in the case in question, then the court can use it. But I think they're just talking about, yeah, it's going to be a factual conclusion. So, conclusion, common law mailbox rule allows taxpayers to prove timely files their tax returns through credible evidence of proper mailing. Wrong. While the IRS prefers physical proof, courts have recognized credible testimony and other evidence under the common law mailbox rule as demonstrating cases like Anderson Estate versus Wood, both of which are pre-2011, and the Sallow case, which doesn't exist. So, definitely, incomplete answers. Misleading answer, right? And just absolutely wrong when it talks about the Sallow case. Right, so what's going on here? In addition to finding this fictional Sallow case, it misstates the current law based on Regulation 300.7502-1 as revised by the IRS in 2011. That's important to know that in 2011, IRS finally says, look, we can't have these, you know, different rulings in different circuits. They're all admitting the law is not clear. Under the Mayo Clinic case from the Supreme Court, the IRS has the right to issue regulations to resolve that as long as their interpretation is reasonable. So they took the path that the Supreme Court says they're allowed to take and resolve the issue, right? And generally, since that date, the courts have backed it up. Now, the regulation provides that certified and registered mail provides proof of the postmark, right? So that's the way you could do it, okay? But what's more important is the second part. Certified registered mail are the sole way to prove that there has been actual delivery, to give a prima facie reason. And the big thing about that is, even if the return literally was not delivered, it was who knows what post office did with it, right? They just totally, I had a check a few years ago for about $25,000 being sent to our office, and it's never appeared anywhere. You know, the person that sent it never saw it again. We've never seen it. Nobody's ever seen it. So there are documents that go missing in the mail. It just happens. This protects you against that. And it provides that this shall be the sole method by which you can establish delivery unless you can prove actual delivery to the IRS, that the document got to the IRS, which is going to be difficult. And if you can, then your problem is, can you prove the postmark? Because now you got to prove what postmark was on the envelope. So unless the post office like shows you the postmark and lets you take a picture before it disappears, you know, and you film the whole process, you'd have trouble showing the postmark. So realistically, registered or certified mail, or as the reg will also say, a qualified private delivery service or electronic filing are your methods to establish timely filing. Any other way you attempt to do it is almost certainly doomed to fail. It becomes incredibly difficult in that situation to have a proof of timely filing. So courts have now generally also ruled that 7502 is not in addition to the common law mailbox rule, but supplants it. But that was the purpose of it. So, you know, you can't use the common law mailbox rule to get around the fact you can't prove the 7502A requirements of having it postmarked and actually delivered. Certified mail proves the date of postmark on the white receipt you're given, and it proves and it gives prima facie evidence of the actual delivery, putting the burden on the IRS to show it wasn't delivered. Very difficult for them to do that, right? You might say impossible. ChatGPT's answers is at best incomplete and misleading, and at worst just flat out wrong. Depending on how you want to read it. I would give this particular answer, if I was grading it, a D, if not a D minus. Right? It does have some factual content. They did find some things, but it totally made up a case, which is bad. Usually if you're grading something, somebody's essay, and you discover they're making things up, that's not going to go down well. It missed a key point of the 2011 regs, never mentioned them, right? And it missed the fact that in recent years, this is nobody is working with the Anderson case, you know, at this point, or with the Wood case. Those are simply not being used anymore. So yeah, it's a problem. In a big way, it's a problem for what ChatGPT did. And like I say, non-existent case, if you're in an exam and you're citing non-existent cases, your credibility just went to zero. So be very careful. This is not a search engine replacement. So even as the taxpayer advocate suggested that, you know, you need to be careful on the consumer tax offer, I'm suggesting you need to be very, very careful even in the context of professional usage, right? ChatGPT is not a tax research service, period. There are some specialized services that are trying to do different training and get it done. Last I checked, while they are far less likely to hallucinate tax answers, the one time I knew read in tax notes regarding a sort of study done against the set, yes, the dedicated one versus ChatGPT, you know, didn't have hallucinate answers nearly as often, but it's still in a complex question involving, I believe it was that same 5471 penalty. It hallucinated the answer. It gave an answer that was not backed up by anything. Right? That's the problem. It's very, very difficult. The large language model design means it really, really, really wants to give an answer. And eventually, you're going to come up with conditions where that push to give an answer is going to override the fact that the answer is totally made up. So this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June 17th. If you have any questions, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I also participate on the Connect sites for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, and Illinois, and Idaho. So if you have any questions, check there. Otherwise, we hope to see you back here next week. We'll talk about whatever's been going on in the area of current federal tax developments.